Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new state auditor report has revealed an organizational mess in the oversight of charter schools at the Ohio Department of Education, but the office did not find any signs of malice. We're talking about that and more on a weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
And Cincinnati State Government reporter Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So what about the timing of this? It was quietly released just before Thanksgiving. Coincidence, Andy Chow?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the Democrats want to make you think that it was thrown out with the trash and thrown out at a time where no one was really paying attention. It could be the case. I mean, this is something that the auditor's been looking into for 3 years now, for a couple of years now. This is something that happened in 2015. Usually, I mean, if you wanted to really read the signs, usually when the auditor puts something out, he makes a big deal about it. When it's something that's high profile like this, he would call a press conference or send out a press release. This was something that was just, it was released just like any other audit, any other special audit. And then reporters sort of found it on their own. What it found was that this 2015 incident, this is when the former chief of the community schools within the Ohio Department of Education, when
David Hansen,
when he was putting together the reviews of e-schools, online charter schools, he left out F grades. And he was then, this was discovered. He either quit or was fired a couple of days later. I think he resigned a couple of days later.
Resigned under pressure.
Right. And then
I think is the official term.
And the issue here is that leaving those F grades off of the performance evaluations made these online charter schools look a little bit better than they actually were. And in doing so, you know, that helps their sponsor status. And it also helped the Ohio Department of Education when they were filing a grant application to get money from the feds. So this had long-term consequences. This was a big deal in 2015. What the auditor was looking into was who else was involved. Did somebody tell David Hansen to do this? Who knew what he was doing and when?
Mm-hmm.
And did then State Superintendent Dick Ross know about it? Did he ask him to do it, or did anybody within the governor, within Governor Kasich's administration know about it?
And the answer is,
we don't know. It's kind of inconclusive. this report, this audit shows what a mess this was over at the Department of Education,
or ostensibly a mess.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, as Andy was kind of saying, this had to do with the sponsor evaluations for charter schools. And in order for a charter school to operate, you have to have a sponsor. And the state has implemented some new sponsor evaluations, authorizers also called. And so by, you know, they left out, he decided to leave out the e-school grades. And,
On his own,
David Hansen. But he told a lot of people about it. He told a number of senior staff at the Department of Education that this is what he was doing. And the audit actually said that the department's senior staff didn't quite grasp the just how big of a deal this was of what he was actually doing. And they didn't no one has said they ever told the then superintendent Dick Ross about it. Dick Ross was John Kasich's guy as superintendent. Ross said he never knew about it until it was came up at a state school board meeting. The senior staffers never stepped in to try to stop it, never shared it. David Hansen said, "Well, I got advice from my legal counsel that I was in the right here." And it turned out, I think even Dick Ross, it was Dick Ross or somebody else, was asked about the legal counsel that he got. He said, "Yeah, I think David Hansen basically manipulated a young lawyer into giving him an answer that he wanted." And so, look, this was not the senior legal counsel in the department. This was a young legal staffer who I don't think was too far out of off the bar exam. And so this was not someone who is, you know, that you're going to put this kind of a massive decision on top of. And look, there was all kinds of problems. Dick Ross didn't want to talk to the auditor's office. He refused. They had to subpoena him. There were record problems. There were emails that the auditor's office were getting that didn't say who they were to and from. Mm-hmm. Those were scrubbed off. There was problems with the fact that they let Hansen have control of his laptop and phone after they knew he was going to be fired, and he had the ability to go in and manipulate data if he needed to,
or have data just cleared altogether.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this was a big mess.
And so what Jim's saying is exactly what happened in the auditor's report. The big term that the auditor kept using was a lack of internal control, whereas somebody like David Hansen could go and run this by somebody, maybe not the person he needs to run it by, talk to some people, maybe not the people he needs to be talking to, and then also maybe there wasn't enough oversight from somebody like Dick Ross, the superintendent, who should have been monitoring this a little more closely.
Well, and so ultimately this report found that there was no malicious intent, but one has to question, with all of the holes here, you know, maybe there was some intent.
How do they define malicious intent?
Well, there had to be – I don't know the exact legal definition, yeah, but there had to be some – you know, I'm guessing he was looking for some kind of an email, some kind of a statement from someone they talked to who said, yes, we did this, even though we knew it probably wasn't right, but we wanted to help out the sponsors to ensure that the e-schools didn't bring them down. The problem was the e-schools are huge, especially ECOT and Ohio Virtual Academy.
At that time, now, of course,
yeah,
it's
and now gone.
But
being so large, they made up a large number of the students that these sponsors oversaw in terms of you may have 10 or 12 schools, but if you've got ECOT in your portfolio, ECOT's F grade is going to mean a lot more than all those other schools that have 400 to 600 students apiece. When ECOT was claiming at the time 15,000 to 18,000, so you know it was a big deal to eliminate them from these grades. And then after it was discovered, almost by happenstance, I mean, this is all just strange. You know, Senator Peggy Lehner actually brought it up at a school board meeting. She's a non-voting member of the school board and asked, you know, well, what are we doing here? And at that point, David Hansen wasn't even in the room. And somebody said, well, David mm-hmm. Hansen needs to talk about that. And they said, well, go get him.
Yeah, they had to call him down.
And Dick Ross at the time was kind of annoyed that they were forcing David Hansen to come down and answer questions about this.
By the way, David Hansen has a further connection to the Kasich administration. His wife is chief of staff.
Yes. Mm-hmm. His wife's chief of staff for John Kasich.
So, and then small after, potatoes.
So after this is all rolled out and discovered, then Dick Ross says, okay, we're going to – he says he put together an internal investigation into what happened. However, the person he puts in charge of it says, hell, I didn't even know I was in charge of it. I didn't know this was really an mm-hmm. internal investigation. I thought we were just asking some questions and making – you know, and several people involved in this, including the data person, were all like, we're just – you know, no one really understood what the investigation was supposed to find and what the questions were supposed to be answered, and that it was all very haphazardly done and not well. Again, it was.
Gosh, I wonder how much this cost the Ohio taxpayers.
Well, another phrase used in the auditor's report was, differing recollections. So one person remembered it one
right.
way, one person remembered it a different way.
And we have scrubbed emails and whatnot
evidence. And I mean Dick Ross's chief of staff at the time was supposedly the one put in charge, even though when interviewed under by the auditors he basically said I didn't know I was in charge, and they kept pressing him on it, and his answer was something to the effect of, are you guys just trying to make me look bad? Why are you asking me if I'm in charge?
Well, what's the result of something like this? Often have there been new checks and balances put in place in the Department of Education? We know it's run by almost a completely different team.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you asked, within the Department of Education, yes, there's a new superintendent now. Well, he's not new now, but he came in to replace Dick Ross. And as far as they say that there are more internal controls in place, that, the spokesperson for the Ohio Department of Education after this audit came out said that they are committed to strong oversight of the community schools review system, the charter school review system. The department is saying that the auditor, who Auditor Dave Yost, who will not be auditor at the end of this year, he'll go mm-hmm. on to become attorney general. But this has been something that the auditor's office has been following for 8 years now. Dave Yost has been a strong critic of the Department of Education, and he said many times before that he thinks it's the worst run organization within the state.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We've been talking about the state auditor's report that popped out very quietly just before the holiday. We're talking about it now because it's pretty big news. They found that things were horribly mismanaged in the Department of Education, but that there was no malice, at least none that they could detect. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the ECOT scandal, is it winding down? Is there more to come? Any sense about whether there's any more shoes to drop in that?
The only thing that I can think of right now is that there still is a pending lawsuit against ECOT founder Bill Lager to recoup money from the whole fallout from the whole scandal where ECOT overbilled the state for students it didn't have. So the state is still collecting that money and still collecting damages for other things within the ECOT fallout. So the state is suing Bill Lager for some of his assets and some other former high-ranking ECOT officials as well. So there is still a lawsuit out there that Mike DeWine is heading up.
Right. It's a lawsuit based on whether or not Bill Lager is legally an agent of ECOT, who acted improperly by also contracting with his own companies through ECOT, through his for-profit management and for-profit software companies. That is also part of this as well. Is like if they're kind of trying to take a new tactic here and saying that yes, not only was Bill Lager the founder of ECOT, but he was acting as an agent and should have had a fiduciary duty to ECOT, and he broke that by contracting with himself basically to make money through his other companies. Now, there's in this situation, there's what does your eyes tell you and what is legal. Those can be two different things. Your eyes tell you absolutely he was ECOT, and this was all bundled into one thing. ECOT would send millions and millions of dollars per year to Bill Lager's company so that Bill Lager could make money and provide services to ECOT. I mean, it was all one thing. But legally, was he did he have a fiduciary duty to ECOT? That's a little dicier when it comes to trying to prove that. And there's also Dave Yost at one point did also send over fraud charges or potential fraud charges over to Franklin County and federal prosecutors to see if those were going to be pursued. Haven't heard really anything about that. And I think Ron O'Brien is kind of deferring right now to the feds. I know the FBI has been looking into Bill Lager's contributions and whether or not he was illegally repaying some of his employees for big contributions that they were making to Republicans. So there's some things still out there on the table.
What about that federal grant that they were whatever happened to that?
Well, I think the U.S. Department of Education had to go back and review a new grant application. So I think one was sent to the feds, and then when this whole fallout happened with David Hansen, I believe, if I'm remembering it right, they sent a new application out, and then they were still rewarded a big pot of money that could go to charter schools, good charter schools, to create more good charter schools. So the charter schools that are performing well in Ohio would get the money to be able to try to replicate whatever they're doing in more places.
It was highly scrutinized. They put us under some kind of special, I forget the term. The feds said we're under some kind of special watch with this $71 million grant. So that unlike normally when they would have just given it over to us, they're requiring a lot more documentation and oversight.
We got our eyes on you.
Yep.
Okay. All right. We will continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. We have Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jesse Ballmert from the Cincinnati Enquirer. If you have a question or comment, we're going to be talking about national politics a little bit. It looks like two statewide office holders in Ohio, U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown and also Governor John Kasich. Of course, he's being term limited out of office, but for the meantime, he is a statewide office holder. Considering a run for president. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Two top elected officials from Ohio are mulling a run for the Oval Office. We're talking about that on our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us from the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Okay, so both Governor Kasich and U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown appeared on This Week with George Stephanopoulos to talk about the same thing, running for president in 2020. Republican John Kasich's comments were familiar.
We need different leadership. There isn't any question about it. And I'm not only just worried about the tone and the name-calling and the division in our country, and the partisanship, but I also worry about the policies, you know, rising debt, the problem in inability to deal with immigration, the problems that we have as America alone in the world. You know, this is what I consider a rotten deal with the Saudis to look the other way. I mean, these are things that, George, I'm worried about our country.
And Sherrod Brown said that his musings began post-midterm.
Since the election, Connie and I have been really overwhelmed by the number of people from around the country that have said we should think about doing this. And I haven't made trips to Iowa or New Hampshire. I haven't done any of those things to prepare, which is fine because the Iowa caucuses are 13 months away. But we're seriously thinking about it. We're seriously talking about it.
Okay, so Sherrod Brown said he hadn't visited Iowa or New Hampshire, noting that the Iowa caucuses are 13 months away. That's not keeping John Kasich.
Yeah,
he's counting.
He hasn't
exactly
thought about it, though.
13 months away. You know that none of them, that nothing, they're always thinking about this kind of stuff.
Has anyone in history ever been underwhelmed by the people telling them to run for president?
But, I mean, you know, his name was bandied about as for vice presidential material in the last election. You know, Hillary Clinton famously went with someone different. But, you know, so I think it's kind of must have emerged. The musings must have begun on 2016, Election Day 2016.
And that was something he was asked over and over again before Hillary Clinton picked Tim Kaine. People kept asking, do you want to be her running mate? Do you want to be vice president? So that's something that he had to handle a lot back in 2016. And he basically gave a definitive no most of the time. I don't know if it's because he had already been interviewed and he already went through the vetting process, but it just seemed like something that truly wasn't on his radar, something he truly didn't want to do. I think what we're definitely seeing from between 2016 and now is a clearer idea of what the landscape is throughout the country and here in Ohio, what the political landscape is for what voters want. And it is pretty clear that, at least in Ohio, voters do want somebody like Sherrod Brown. He's somebody who can win the state by a wide margin.
And there's still, despite, you know, there's going to be, we're going to lose one electoral. I mean, there are.
After the census?
The census.
Mm-hmm. That's something where, in Ohio, where it went definitively read down the ticket other than Sherrod Brown, I think that says something to him, to Democrats, and to people nationwide that maybe something within his message is something that can connect with people.
Yeah, and I know our editorial board asked Sherrod Brown maybe even just a few weeks before his re-election to the U.S. Senate bid about whether this is something on his radar, and he kind of demurred at the time. So it is something that people had been talking about, especially when they thought that he was going to kind of run up the score against U.S. Representative Jim Renacci, the Republican who was running against him. And it makes sense. You know, you think back to how John Kasich did so well against Ed Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of put him on the radar of Republicans nationally as someone, wow, like he can win 86 out of 88 counties in Ohio.
Well, against a non-candidate in the final analysis.
I don't think national folks realize that, though, honestly. And so I think they'll look at Sherrod Brown and say, look, this guy can win the state by 6 points when Trump is winning it by, you know, 8 or 9 points in the opposite direction, and see that as something valuable. I think a lot of the other candidates that are, you know, mulling bids are from either the East Coast or the West Coast. And mm-hmm. so there is some desire to have like the Ohio Midwestern candidate in mm-hmm. the race. I don't know if that ultimately means he runs, but I do think those are all reasons why folks are talking to him about it.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of Sherrod Brown impersonators out there if he does, if he runs. That'll be a big cottage industry.
I really do think that the Democrats are, national Democrats are giving this a very serious look given just who's winning across the state or across the nation, who's losing across the nation. And the message that Sherrod Brown has here has consistently been about workers and labor. And I think, again, like Jesse said, anybody who comes to Ohio to run for president can get, if you're not from Ohio, if you're not from the Midwest, you're going to be hit with the tag coastal elite or DC insider. And if you do run somebody from the Midwest, somebody like Sherrod Brown, that's something that you get to avoid. And again, it seems like his message about workers and labor is connecting with people.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't a lot of Democrats right now who are rising up to as obvious big
name
candidates.
No, there's just a lot of Democrats.
Sure, and that's what happens when you when you don't have a true front runner. You end up with, you know, 15. You know,
which is what the Republicans went through a few years ago, right? So.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, at some point, somebody will, you know, somebody or a few people will start to emerge. You know, you've got to raise money. You got to have some organization to be serious. And, you know, Sherrod Brown can do that. The you know, just a lot of questions still to be answered about his desire. And,
Let's talk about John Kasich for a second. This is nothing new. This is the same thing he's been saying every Sunday on some talk show. For the last 2 years, practically, almost literally every Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Does it sound different now?
I think what John Kasich is doing and what he has been doing is positioning himself for whatever is next. And if that is, you know, speaking on a national talk show or, you know, being a member of the board of directors of some business, being seen as this person who's willing to challenge the president is good for John Kasich's brand. If it means challenging Donald Trump as either an independent or a Republican, this is also a good place for him to be. I think a lot of John Kasich's path forward depends on President Donald Trump having some sort of fall from grace.
Which trying to figure out what that might be is the $6 million question.
Right? And I'm not sure if there's a big path if that doesn't happen in some massive way. So you're positioning yourself to be there if something like that happens, but I don't know if it happens. And if it doesn't happen, does John Kasich proceed ahead anyway? That's the big question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to imagine him beating Donald Trump in a Republican primary. Mm-hmm. I don't think these days John Kasich would win a Republican primary in Ohio over Donald Trump. I think his approval ratings right now seem to be higher among Democrats in Ohio than Republicans. Yeah. So he would have a very tough time. But like you said, if you keep yourself in the spotlight, keep yourself positioned right in case. Because, look, Democrats are about to take over the House and start doing investigations. The Mueller report is on the runway and getting ready to take off. I mean, these are things that could seriously impact Donald Trump in some very negative ways. Now, some of his supporters are going to stand by him no matter what. At the same time, if you want to be ready just in case. And again, if that doesn't happen, look, John Kasich was a television talk show host before he became governor, and there's no reason to think he couldn't go back to doing something similar.
Could he go back to that and run from a position like that, Andy Chow, for president? So what does he do? I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, laurels for a few months, and
I guess if you
want
to, I think he'd have a better shot being a contributor rather than a TV show host.
Yeah.
For several reasons, but I think. It all depends. And I think what Jesse and Jim are saying about he's sort of just positioning himself as the Republican in waiting in case there ever is such a major backlash against Donald Trump where people have either Trump fatigue or anti-Trump feelings that they want to see Kasich as the conservative alternative. But again, I think he's just trying to stay in the spotlight, trying to stay in the national psyche until even when that moment happens. But I think if he does go on to become an actual host of a TV show, I don't know. I think that would be a rare sight to see of a host of a TV show then running for national office.
Yeah, that, I don't know.
I mean, from Jerry Springer land, it's not necessary.
Yeah, I mean, really, who knows? But I think if he does that route, I think that's what he's doing. And he's not going to consider a run for president, at least this cycle.
Also, keep an eye on the economy. We are already.
I'm just trying not to look at my.
To stop looking at your retirement. 401k.
Yeah.
And look, we are, and this is not rooting for anything. This is simply straight out facts that we are overdue in this country for a recession. We just are. We traditionally have recessions every 8 to 10 years. We are now at 10. And we are now running kind of on overtime on this economic growth. It's been unprecedented economic growth, and that's a great thing. But in the next 2 years, does that continue to hold? Maybe. And if it does, that'll definitely benefit Trump. If it doesn't, it's going to be interesting, because that is one of his number one things he can talk about is the fact that the economy has continued to roar while he's been in office.
Well,
go ahead.
If you sit down with any Trump supporter, somebody who may have voted for Trump in 2016 and who is still now a Trump supporter, the number one thing most people will say is, I don't care what he says. I don't care about his, rash, bombastic statements. I care that I'm still getting my paycheck, or I care that the economy is doing well. And I think that's what a lot of people lean back on. And a lot of people say, you hear the statements he's making, but really, what's really changed in America? Those are some of the sentiments that you hear from Trump supporters. So Jim's right. If there is a drastic change in something like the economy, that's when you might start to see some approval rating fall.
Speaking of a shaky looking economy, feel strong now. There are rumblings, and as Jim pointed out, we're overdue for a correction, recession. But what about the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation? Not workers' compensation, unemployment.
Unemployment compensation.
Yeah. The chorus.
Yeah,
has that been resolved yet
what?
In Ohio?
Oh, boy. Sure. Yeah. That can has run out of road to kick down. Let's put it that way. My goodness. Who thought road could be that long?
It's right around the corner now, and they still have not resolved that. And my point is that they have not resolved the unemployment insurance issue in Ohio. They just finished paying off the debt from the last recession to the federal government. What's more, people aren't making as much money. I mean, this recovery has been good for the economy writ large, but a lot of the jobs that have been created are not those high-paying jobs with benefits that were lost over the last 30 years.
I haven't heard any chatter about addressing that in lame duck. I don't know if you guys have.
Yeah, so I took a look at various bills that are still out there that got a lot of talk earlier in the year, and unemployment compensation was one of them, and I just don't see it happening before the end of the year. The person who is really tasked with taking a look at this is Representative Kirk Schering. And he was trying to get, labor and businesses to be on the same page. Really, what it comes down to is you either have to cut weeks and payments, or you have to
increase fees
and so forth. And it's a balancing act, and neither side really wants to let go of their power. But at some point, they're going to have to. And the end result is worse, probably for everyone, certainly for businesses, if we have to borrow money from the federal government. So I don't think there is a lot of impetus to get this done. I think Kirk Schering is going to go over.
Not even a recession in the offing.
I think Kirk Schering is going to go over to the Ohio Senate, and I'd be surprised if it gets done over there.
You got to remember the setup of all this. So right now we're in 2018 in the lame duck session. 2 years ago, in 2016, during the last lame duck session, it looked like we were very, very close to seeing a bill passed to reform the unemployment compensation system. Then all of a sudden, the next day, they had an early morning press conference with members from labor, members from business communities gathering together saying, we're not going to pass a bill during this lame duck. Instead, we are promising to come together for a committee where we can craft a bill in 2017 that'll pass in April of 2017.
Yep, April.
It is November of 2018.
Time warp. Yeah. Okay.
And we just still haven't seen it. Again, at the end of all those talks, at the end of those blue ribbon committees, Kirk Schering came out with a proposal basically saying, hey, I crafted this. You know, business takes a hit. Workers take a hit. But in the end, it's sort of sharing the burden. And nobody was for it. And nobody wanted to see it pass. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah, both sides have really dug in on this because they can. And look, I mean, we're talking about borrowing, what was it, $5
billion?
$3 to $4 billion. $4 billion?
Yeah.
I get it somewhere.
Yeah,
isn't it? $4 billion last time we had to borrow recession.
And they had to pay interest on
that. Oh, yeah, have to pay interest. And businesses take a hit on that. They have to pay a surcharge when that's the case. So. So look, labor knows this. Labor knows that. Look, why do we need to give up anything? It's business who ends up paying if we have to borrow again. Business, of course, is like, wait a minute. Last I checked, Republicans control all branches of government. Why are we taking a hit on this? Well, I'll tell you why. One reason is that the labor movement in this state, labor unions, trade unions especially, have started giving millions and millions of dollars to Republican legislators. And that, if you don't think that has had an impact, well, you're probably not listening to the show right now because you know better if you're listening right now.
If you've ever listened before, you
so,
know.
So that's where it is. I mean, you've got business who don't want to take a hit. You've got labor who doesn't want to take any cuts. And both sides are very politically strong right now. They're giving a lot of money. They're very influential, and I don't think they're in. And you really, it would take a special bit of political courage in order to pass a bill that's going to make both of those entities angry. And so far, we have not seen that courage emerge.
We're going to talk about what kind of courage we are seeing emerge in this lame duck session coming up. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, and also with us, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. If you have a question or comment about lame duck, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio is in a lame duck session now when lawmakers wrap up business before the end of the term, or not. We're talking about this on our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us from Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel, Andy Chow, the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Jesse, you wrote about the lame duck session for the Enquirer. What are you predicting Ohioans will see get done?
Well, there are a few things that the Ohio House actually just kind of ripped the Band-Aid off on right away during lame duck session last a couple weeks ago. We had the kind of package of gun proposals, which are called Stand Your Ground. Basically, it would eliminate the duty to retreat if you have to fire upon someone in the open spaces and public spaces, not your house or your car, which is already protected by Castle Doctrine. And also, it would shift the burden of proof on self-defense. Essentially, right now, the person who fired the shot has to prove that they acted in self-defense. Now, it would be the prosecutor's job to prove that they didn't act in self-defense. And so that was a proposal that the Ohio House passed a couple weeks ago. It's something that I think you're likely to see the Ohio Senate take up. Another proposal that the House passed is the so-called heartbeat bill, which would effectively ban abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, which can be as early as 6 weeks gestation. And so that has exceptions for the life of the mother, but doesn't for rape or incest. And that got a lot of debate on the floor and ultimately passed. The margin was The yeas had 60 votes, which is what they are going to need to override a veto from John Kasich. John Kasich, the governor, has promised to veto both of these proposals. So if they get to him, I think you're going to expect the lawmakers having to try to do an override.
Right. And they're going to try to do an override. Why? Because Mike DeWine has said he would sign at least the heartbeat bill into law. So why not just wait? Why go through the trouble of having to override a veto, Andy Chow?
Well, I think for one thing, if you can do it now, they would do it now. It's like going for two and winning the game rather than sending it to overtime. If they think that they can do it now and win the game, then I think they would do it now. There's also been a little bit of bad blood between Republican lawmakers and Governor John Kasich. So there's not really a lot of motivation for them to allow him a political win. I mean, that's a little bit of assuming, but that's another thing. And again, I go back to the first point, which is, I mean, it's taken 2 years for them to get the heartbeat bill through both sessions. If we assume that the Senate passes it, then it would take 2 years to get it that far. With hours and hours of testimony, public testimony, floor speeches, I think that's
galore.
Yeah, I think that's the motivation there.
I think there's a couple other things that play into it to a lesser extent. Number one, the top priority in January is going to be the budget, and so I think there's a lot less attention on other bills at that point for both the governor-elect and the legislature. Number two is the House is going to maintain their supermajority, but they are going to have fewer Republican members. And given the kind of already existing divisions between those who support Ryan Smith for Speaker versus Larry Householder for Speaker, I think they see their coalition as a little bit stronger this year than it will be next year.
So that package of bills, by the way, that wasn't the same package or didn't have any bear any resemblance to the package that Governor Kasich sent over post Florida mass shooting at the high school. Those are all effectively dead.
Well, they're sitting in committee right now. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of political will to move them forward unless they want to use it as some sort of gambling chip to get Kasich to sign something else. But as of right now, I think it's still sitting in a House committee.
Yeah. And I think early in the process, there was some hope that maybe this would be picked off. And there are five different proposals ranging from, you know, armor-piercing
ammunition
to probably the most controversial piece of this is this red flag law that would allow relatives or police to go to a court and say, hey, I think this person shouldn't have access to guns because of mental health or you know, violent tendencies and temporarily remove them. The legislature is just really not on board with that. But I think there was some interest in picking off other portions of this, maybe looking at shoring up how we are doing, making sure names get into the background check system to make sure people who aren't allowed to have guns don't get them. I just don't know if that's going to happen anymore. I do think like both sides have really dug in on this issue. And I think John Kasich has really become more like pass this package of bills as a whole or don't mess with it.
I mean, I think it's a good issue for the urban areas and suburbs. I think this issue still resonates in terms of what Kasich is proposing, some of these gun safety measures. However, Republicans increasingly are not representing those areas anymore. And
Republicans control the Ohio General Assembly.
Right. Particularly after this last election, they've all but been kicked out of Franklin County. I think there's now starting next year, it'll be a 9-1 Democrat for House seats in Franklin County. I think it's 9-2 in Cuyahoga County. And Hamilton, I think, is they lost another Republican suburban representative there just recently as well. So those are the kind of things that if you had more Republicans in the suburbs where this issue plays better, I think maybe it's some more support might build up. But I don't know that if they don't see the political gain in it, I don't know that they're going to do it.
Raquel in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Raquel.
Hi. I was just wondering, how does the heartbeat bill not cause undue burden?
Okay, so this is something I wanted to follow up on is what's going to be the hitch here if it is enacted? Is it going to immediately go into litigation over that issue of undue burden or what?
I think if this is passed over John Kasich's veto, you would see an immediate legal challenge. You've seen legal challenges in other states, and federal courts have rejected this proposal. And the U.S. Supreme Court had an opportunity to take it up and decided not to. I think supporters of this bill think this is a good way to challenge Roe v. Wade, and that maybe the U.S. Supreme Court would be more willing to take a look at it now than they have in the past. But I don't think you see this. I think this is immediately challenged and placed on hold.
And this is why you see even anti-abortion groups who are against the heartbeat bill.
Ohio Right to Life.
Because they have a certain agenda. Their agenda is to wipe out abortion altogether, but they have a plan to do that. And this kind of throws a hitch in their plan. This kind of skips a couple of steps. And so I think what they're afraid of is passing this too soon will undo the other restrictions that they've already gone through. And I think they see it as a slower process to get to their ultimate goal. Because Jesse's right and the caller's right, this will immediately go to court.
There are other states, though, as you mentioned, that are also in litigation over this issue. Any sense about what it'll take for the Supreme Court to take it up? I mean, we saw the same sort of thing with gay marriage, right? And what does it take?
I don't know. I have no idea what it'll take. But, I mean, the court has obviously changed. And with Trump having two nominees and so two appointments. And so there is a growing belief that the court is now shifting and may be willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. I don't know if heartbeat
is the way
to go or not. I'm not going to say it isn't or is. Maybe mm-hmm. it is. But it would definitely push the limits beyond what the courts have said is permissible, which right now is a viability standard, which is around 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's going to be and as we're talking about this, just there's no guarantee on the heartbeat bill, especially there's no sure thing that the House and Senate have a veto proof override. Mm-hmm. The House dragged one member back into the House to vote late to get to a 60 votes now. But just because you have 60 votes on the original vote doesn't mean you're going to keep 60 votes. Which is the minimum you need for an override. For
closer we get to the holidays,
yeah,
the harder
for
that
the
is to hold.
For an override vote, and the Senate, they would also be very close on whether or not they would have the votes for an override mm-hmm. on the heartbeat bill.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, I'm forgetting the state, but I think it was either Missouri or Mississippi. One of them, the lawmakers tried to pass a 16-week ban, and I believe the state court ruled against it. And so there's already litigation in place for things like this that mm-hmm. those proposed bills are losing in the court, which means it's working its way up the system already.
Okay. Secretary of State John Husted announced plans to begin a voter purge in Ohio. Of course, he's lieutenant governor-elect now. What are we talking about here? Is this just business as usual for John Husted, or what's going on?
So I think earlier this year, recently, mm-hmm. we had a U.S. Supreme Court decision saying that this process was allowed. And mm-hmm. so what he's doing is really just implementing that process that is allowed. There's been a couple of court decisions saying, you know, hey, hold off on this. Let's wait to do it later. And those have since been cleared. And so I think he just sees it proceeding. The thing I thought was interesting is a couple of people talked to Frank LaRose, the incoming Secretary of State.
Right.
About this process, and it seems like he's less likely to take it up going forward. I don't know.
He's not. He's saying that he won't be. Essentially, he's saying he won't be as aggressive in cleaning out the voter rolls as John Husted has been, and LaRose, Secretary of State-elect LaRose, would want to create other systems in place to encourage people to either update their registration or go out and vote. Because the question here is if somebody hasn't voted in a certain number of years, then they are sent a notification saying, hey, you've been an inactive voter. You need to either respond to this notification, go vote in the next election, or update your address. And if you don't do any of those things, we're going to take your name off the voter roll. What LaRose is saying is that he wants to create something to make sure that people really do respond to these notifications.
And for what it's worth, this is one way people are removed from the rolls. There are other systems in place to remove people who have passed away mm-hmm. or, you know, moved out of state, et cetera. And so this process of removing people who haven't voted as frequently is really the kind of controversial bit.
Yeah, and it's a constant balancing act. I mean, you want your voter rolls to be fairly clean. You know, it's never going to be perfect, but you don't want it clogged up with a whole bunch of people who have since, you know, haven't voted in, you know, 12 or 15 years and have probably moved twice since then. And so, you know, it just it causes problems, not just for security, but also for logistics. You know, it's kind of sometimes it can be hard to tell how many machines should I have at a certain mm-hmm. precinct if the voter rolls are filled with people who aren't actually going to vote. But at the same time, there's genuine concern about kicking people off just because they haven't voted for 6 years. Some say that is just too short of a time and is purging people who may just decided they for a few years they didn't feel like there was anything worth voting for and they shouldn't be punished for that.
Yeah, the Supreme Court case involved a voter who just didn't think that he didn't like any of the nominees on one voting slate. And then the next time around, he didn't like any of the nominees. But then a ballot issue, I think it was the marijuana ballot issue, came up in Ohio. And then he decided that is something worth going to the polls for. And then he got to the polls and realized that his name had been cleared off the rolls.
Just switching gears real quick here before we go. High school graduation rules. It looks like Ohio is going to again delay or maybe abandon the state's more rigorous graduation requirements. What's up with that? And when are they ever going to just clamp down or...
Speaking of kicking the can down the road,
yeah, this is it the end of that road too, or what?
Well, the state has been trying to implement higher graduation standards to raise the bar on what it means to have a high school diploma, mm-hmm. but we're finding that a large amount of students would not be able to graduate if those standards were to be kept in place. So, for the class of 2018, the General Assembly essentially lowered the bar to create these, quote, alternate pathways in order to graduate. So including things like attendance and capstone projects, other things to be able to get more people to graduate, to become high school graduates. We're seeing the same problem where a large amount of students are not on path to graduate for the class of 2019. So the lawmakers are considering extending those alternate pathways again. Meanwhile, the State Department of Education the state school board is saying we got to change these standards permanently. They've created a whole new proposal that would be a permanent proposal that the General Assembly can maybe consider next year. But in the meantime, they're thinking about the class of 2019 and what they should do. And it seems like there's a lot of will there to extend those alternate pathways for the class of 2019.
I'm exhausted just thinking about having to do it all over again, but... Mm-hmm.
Well, it kind of reminds me of it's similar in the sense to school funding. It's like you come up with an idea to kind of change to fix what you think was broken before, and then you create new problems. And with education standards, this is a constant pendulum swing in Ohio. We go from we're not testing enough, and kids are graduating without knowing anything. So they swing the pendulum too far the other way. Now we're testing too much. Our graduation requirements are too weak. Well, now they're too tough. I don't know when they ever get to a right balance.
Stay tuned for more. That is Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you, Jim. Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, thanks to you. And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.